So this is the last teaching of this session of talks, and it's a nice, easy one for me, a fun one for you, but also nice and deep as well. The title of the talk is called Tales of a Forest Monk. Now, some of you, especially those of you who've been talking to me on the retreat, have sometimes read some of these books of the forest monks of Thailand. Monks who lived in the jungle and wrestled with tigers and outraced elephants and faced down snakes. And all of those stories are mostly totally exaggerated. But they're great fun to read. Because I was one of those forest monks. And when I was living in Thailand, there were still jungles around. There were still tigers and bears and elephants and snakes. Deadly snakes. When I was first there in Thailand, I was given the advice, in those jungles of Thailand, there were 100 species of snake. 99 of those species were venomous. If they bit you, that was it. Certain death. And the 100th species would strangle you to death. Either way, they were all deadly. So be careful. But after a while, as a forest monk, the real forest monk, you live very simply. So often, you would not be staying in a hut. You wouldn't be staying in a room. You'd be sleeping on the forest floor, just with a mosquito net to protect you from these venomous animals. And you'd be laying down there and seeing the snakes slither past, with only a fine piece of mosquito net between you and certain death. But we were always taught, and it made common sense. Snakes. What do snakes eat? Have you ever heard of a snake eating monk for lunch? They don't eat monks. They eat usually mice and lizards and things like that. So because I was scientist, a Buddhist, I was rational, I thought, gee, those snakes aren't interested in me, because I'm just too big to eat. So all the snakes wanted to do was to slither past, and as they went past, you said, nice to see you, bye-bye. So you're always kind to those snakes. So what these teachings which you learned, and I'm going to go to many stories, in those jungles, living as a forest monk, you learned so much about life. The live and let live. The tolerance, letting the snakes be. Because as long as you left them alone, they would leave you alone. And if you did meet together, you always had to be kind. And I was told, as long as you give loving kindness, metta, towards those snakes, they will always look after you. And one of these stories is not of me, but one of my fellow monks. And this is the first story of Tales of the Forest Monks. He too was sitting meditation in the jungle. And there were other monks with him who saw this. As he was sitting meditation in the jungle, everyone opened their eyes because they heard an animal coming towards them. And they saw it was that particular species of snake in Thailand called the king cobra. In that part of Thailand, it was called, they had a nickname for it in the northeast, and it was called the one-step snake. The reason it was called the one-step snake, because if it bit you, that's all you had left before you died. One step and fell over, dead. That's how venomous the one-step snake was. And in all those years I was in Thailand, I only saw a king cobra once. And this I'm a monk, okay? I don't exaggerate. I tell the truth. Remember this. So, it was strange. I was in this forest monastery. And you knew that there was something special. So, one of three times, living in the jungle, you knew that something was happening. You knew there was electricity in the air. There was something around. And as I turned a corner in the path, there in front of the path was this big black snake, as thick as the thickest part of your thighs. Men's thighs, that is, not women's thighs. Fat people's thighs. It was thick, and I could not see its head, and I could not see its tail. However, I've always been a scientist, and I always have that sort of scientific idea. The path was about 4 foot wide, 1.2 meters. I know that because you sweep it every day. And so what I did, the snake was moving, and I counted how long that snake was by how many path lengths until its tail came out. And I counted about 7 or 8 path lengths. And I multiplied that by 1.2. And that was at least a 10 meter long snake. Now that's no exaggeration. You look at the books and say king cobras maybe about 6 or 7 meters. But that was a big one. Over 10 meters long. I never saw its head. Ever, thank goodness. That's how long it was. It just went away. But that's how big these snakes are. And being cobras, being king cobras, they are also incredibly dangerous. So imagine this. In the forest, in the late afternoon or evening, the king cobra came up to one of the monks. And it lifted up its head, opened its hood, and went pss, pss, right in front of the monk's nose. Would you be scared? What would you do? Would you run away? That's a stupid thing to do, because I've seen those snakes. It's scary. They can move so fast. It's one of the things you learn living in the forest. You can't outrun one of those snakes. So running away was not an option. So there was the snake. Opened its hood in front of the monk's nose. What this monk did was to raise his hand and pat the snake on the head, saying, "Thank you, snake, for coming to visit me." And what do you think that snake did? Did the snake bite him? Of course not. Snakes like having their head patted. Next time you see one, try it. And that snake just stood there, having his head patted by this very kind monk. And then, when the snake had enough of having its head patted, it closed its hood, went down, went to visit another monk, raised its head, and wanted the other monk to pat. And the other monk said, "No, no, go back to that first monk." Because that first monk had lots of kindness and compassion. And this is what we were taught as forest monks. Go and train with your metta, with your kindness and compassion. Because if you train with your kindness and compassion, you can go live in the jungles, live in the forest amongst very dangerous animals, and nothing will ever harm you. And that was true. As long as you're kind to the snakes, the tigers, in these jungles, they won't harm you. But what meaning is that for our life here in Penang? It means there are many other snakes which you meet in business, tigers which, you know, will try and eat you on the street, elephants which will try and trample you down. I'm talking about people who behave like animals. And so what do? If you're in those situations, in the concrete jungle, when someone tries to attack you, you always remember to have compassion. So what I learned facing snakes and elephants and tigers in the jungles of Thailand, what I learned from that training, I put into practice in places like Australia, because some Australians are very rough. On one occasion, on this one day, we were opening up our new Buddhist center in Perth. This was maybe 15, 20 years ago. About 24 years ago now, I think. And we just purchased this new temple. And we're having an opening ceremony. And I was supposed to organize the tent, the marquee, the chairs, and all that sort of stuff for the event. That was my job. And the treasurer told me, please don't worry about expense. We have enough money in the kitty. We want to put on a really good show. So I found a hire company in Perth, which hired marquees and stuff out to the rich people, the millionaires in their mansions when they had weddings or functions. And I said, doesn't matter how much it costs, we want the best. Do you understand? Yes. And when it came, what did we get? The worst. They delivered this filthy marquee. It was covered with red dust. And all the chairs were filthy. But I'm a monk, I don't complain. If you can fix it, do something about it. There's an old, you should know this, Chinese saying, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. Remember this. Rather light a candle than complain about darkness. Instead of complaining, if there's something you can do, fix it. Instead of getting angry and upset. So, together with my helpers, we got some water, some cloths, we wiped everything down, it was all nice and clean, but there was still a trouble. We had 8 chairs for the VIPs. We had the governor of Western Australia coming. We had politicians, important people. And this, again, is no exaggeration. Of those 8 chairs, there wasn't one chair whose legs were exactly the same length. Every one of those chairs rocked. And as soon, not a little bit, a lot. And when I saw that, and I thought, oh my God, what happens if the governor of Western Australia leans back and falls off? And it was a possibility, because the chair legs weren't level. And I realized there must have been a big mistake. I rushed to the telephone, and I caught the manager, a lady of this hire company, just as she was about to close the office for the weekend. Now, this isn't Penang, this is Australia. People knock off work at 5 o'clock on Friday, and that's religious. They don't work on Saturdays or Sundays. And I caught her just in time. I said, do you remember me? I asked for the best. We're having a big function. We're having the governor of our state coming tomorrow. And the chairs are different lengths. And she said, there must have been a big mistake. I said, yes, fix it. And she said, I will. We'll change the chairs. And I thought, thank you. Now, what I never understood was that all the workers, these rough Australian labourers, they had finished work already. They were in the pub, drinking. And imagine Australians in the pub drinking, finish the week's work, and the manager comes in and says, guys, we have to go back to work. The Buddhists don't like their chairs. These Australians were not happy. They were upset. They were big time upset having to go to work for these Buddhists. So when the truck came, I was waiting for it. And I saw it turn the corner. And it was maybe 150, 200 meters from the corner, halfway, about 100 meters from where I was standing. The truck was still going at maybe 30 kilometers an hour. And one of the men jumped out. One of the Australian, and these big men, about 6 foot, and that was only between his shoulders. And he came up. He had his fist like this. "Where's the bloke in charge? I want to see the bloke in charge." He was so angry. Did I do that very well? I'm quite surprised I could do anger. I haven't done anger for a long time. "Where's the bloke in charge? I want to see the bloke in charge." And he had his fist like this. His eyes were red because he'd been drinking. He was big. He was angry. And who was the bloke in charge? I went up to him and said, "I'm the bloke in charge." I went right up to him and said, "It's me. I'm in charge." And he put his fist right in front of my nose. His eyes were wide like saucers. And he was breathing alcohol into my face. In all my years as a monk, that's the most alcohol I've ever ingested through my nose. He was mad, half drunk, and about to punch me. Now, of course, when you have big celebrations like this and everybody is setting up, there was 30 or 40 people around, all ready to help. But what did they do? They just stood and stared. "Thank you, friends." No one came to help me, and I was going about to get punched. But it was okay. I didn't need any help. If you face tigers and elephants, you can very easily face a drunken Australian labourer. I didn't pat him on the head. I didn't do that. Instead, I just gave him metta, loving kindness. And it was one of those, again, wonderful experiences. If you're about to be threatened with violence, or if someone is about to harm or hurt you, because of my training as a forest monk, because I could get metta up, I wasn't afraid, I could give him lots of metta. And he froze. He couldn't punch me. He couldn't even say anything. He was just looking there at me, and I was just giving them this lovely metta. And I indulged in those few moments. We were staring at each other for about 2 minutes. And that was all the time it took for the truck to park and one of his friends to come out of the truck. And he put his hand over this man's shoulder and said, "Let's unload the chairs." And I said, "I'll help." And we unloaded those chairs together. No violence, no punching, the best of friends. And that's how I dealt with violence in our world. Because even as a monk, sometimes people try violence on you. But if you practice metta, if you've learned that in the forest, it's so easy to be so in control of the situation that no one can harm you. So what I learned in the forests helped me deal with some of the problems you have setting up monasteries in Australia. But not only things like that. Living in those forests alone at night, again with just a mosquito net between you and whatever animals were prowling in the dark denseness of the night. Sometimes you would come across fear. And so we learn from these experiences what fear is and how to deal with fear. Have ever you been afraid? Have you ever been terrified? Have you ever been so scared that you can't even run? One evening, I was sitting meditating. And it was very quiet. The sun had gone down. The forest was pitch black. And just after sunset, when everything gets dark, that's when the animals come out.
They're nocturnal. They sleep during the day and they come out to eat at night. And as I was meditating there, 8, 9, 10 o'clock, it was pretty quiet until I heard a sound of an animal coming right towards me. Now, you've got to be rational about these things. Don't give way to fear. I couldn't see, even if I opened my eyes, I wouldn't be able to see anything because it was black. So I listened very mindfully. See, we get sound effects, special effects in Mahindravama Temple. So I listened very carefully, and that was not the sound of a big animal. That was like a smallish animal. So I carried on meditating. I wasn't worried about it. But as it came closer, it sounded louder. And I thought, that's not a small animal. That's a medium-sized animal. But I thought, it would leave me alone. It's no big deal. So I carried on meditating. And as it came closer, that hurt. As it came closer, that was really loud. And I realized that wasn't a medium-sized animal. That was a big animal. An extreme. You could hear the way it crushed, you know, the twigs and the leaves in the forest. So that's when I really got scared. Big animals like that. It doesn't sound like an elephant. Probably a tiger. And tigers have been known to eat monks. And especially I was in a very dangerous situation being a Westerner. Because Western food had just come to Thailand. So it was fashionable. So I thought, tiger's going to eat Western food today. So I was afraid. I had a flashlight. And I got the flashlight out to see the tiger. It was only a few feet in front of me. And I saw it. It was a tiny mouse. Only about this big. And I couldn't believe it, that a tiny mouse had made so much noise. And then I realized, it wasn't the tiny mouse which made so much noise. Mice make mice noises, but my fear had amplified that noise, and exaggerated, and made it far louder than it really was. And to me, when I was afraid, a mouse sounded like a tiger. Now these are how we understand what fear does to you. Fear amplifies, exaggerates, and makes small things monsters. It was only a small mouse. But I thanked that mouse for teaching me the danger of fear. And fear always turns small things into big things. Sometimes one may have a spot on one's face. It's skin cancer. It's skin cancer. I'm going to die. I've only got a few days to live. Because you're afraid, it actually turns into something negative. Fear kills more people than diseases do. Fear exaggerates. Fear creates a mountain wherever there's a molehill. And that's something which I learned. So after a while, you'd sit in those forests and you'd hear these noises and you'd put aside your fear. And because you had no fear, it was just small things. Little mice, little snakes. And if it was anything big, I would just go past you because you had no fear. Sometimes it's important for us to understand what fear is and learn how to understand it. And it's through understanding these things that we overcome them and they're no longer a problem in our lives. All fear is thinking something terrible is going to happen. Thinking the sound is the very worst thing, when most of the time it isn't. Fear exaggerates the problem. And how do we overcome the fear which happens in life? Is actually keep everything in proportion. A good story to illustrate that. Again, as a forest monk in Thailand, one day I was actually travelling in a bus. And this was a time in northeast Thailand. The buses were very old, much more ancient than you see in Penang. Well, you've got some pretty old buses in this city. But this is even older ones. And because they were so old and they weren't spending much money just on maintenance, some of those buses caught fire. A spark getting into the dirty oil, making a small flame, and soon the whole bus would burst into flames. And some of those buses bursting into flames had killed people. Even one of my fellow monks was on such a bus, and when it burst into flames, he managed to escape, but he lost his bowl, which was in the bus at the time, and his shoes. And there had been a whole series of these buses bursting into fire when I was on one of these buses. Sitting in the front seat, as I usually put monks, as I said, if you want to know why, get a copy of my talk on superstition. I was sitting in the front seat with another monk sitting next to me. And someone shouted from the back, "Fire! Fire!" And there was smoke billowing from the back. The driver slammed on the brakes. The driver, after stopping the vehicle, he jumped out of the window. All of the people rushed out of the door. Even a monk who I was sitting next to rushed out of the door. Usually monks are very patient. "We let you go first, after you." Not this time, no. He was right out, quick. And as for me, I just sat there, nice and peaceful. And everybody went out of the bus, except for me, sitting peacefully. And one other man who investigated the source of the smoke. And he found it was just a cigarette butt, which had just ignited a little bit of paper. He put it out and said, "It's all right, it's safe. This is not a bus fire." And all the people, when they filed in, when they went past me, they bowed, they put their hands up. "Oh, you're such a good monk. You're not afraid of death. You must be enlightened. You must be an arahat." And even the monk sitting next to me who felt really ashamed, "Oh, you're a great monk." However, I wasn't a great monk. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't understand Thai. I was just a stupid monk. It was really nice. People were saying, "Oh, arahat, you're very good." So, sometimes, don't confuse fear with stupidity. Although sometimes not knowing is a great way of overcoming fear. I didn't know what was going on, so I wasn't afraid. But a lot of times, don't exaggerate. So, what are you to be afraid of? But in those forests, in those jungles, it wasn't just animals you had to face. Many of the people who died would be cremated in those jungles. And the reason why was that's where the wood was. So you'd take the corpse out into the nearest forest. You'd gather up the wood and you'd make a pyre and put the deceased person on top and burn it. And sometimes the monks would come and do some chanting, and before nightfall everybody would leave. Even the monks were scared of ghosts, because this was night time. It was dark, and this was cremation grounds, places where you would expect spooky things to happen. And what did you do as a monk? You went and put your mosquito net umbrella there and sat meditation there. And you know why? Because that was the only place where people would leave you alone and you could get some meditation done. Any other place in Thailand, if you went to the forest, people would come up to you. Not to hear teachings, not to learn meditation, not to ask for a Dhamma talk. At that time they come up to you, especially the forest monks who are meditators, to ask for a lottery number. Because they all thought that monks knew lottery numbers. And they come and bow to you, they give you Pepsi, and then they take it away, lottery number please, or no Pepsi. They did that. So a lot of time I went thirsty. I'm not giving you lottery numbers out. So the only way you can get any peace and quiet is to go to the cremation grounds and hang out with the ghosts. They were my friends and protectors. Now, one of the reasons you overcame fear as a monk living in the forest with the animals and the ghosts is because of wisdom, research, understanding. And I mentioned in the talk on superstitions that one of my friends from Cambridge University, and last October I went to visit some of my friends just outside of Cambridge. We had a bit of a reunion, and this friend's wife came along, but this particular friend, Tony Cornell, Dr. Tony Cornell, was a bit too sick, so he couldn't come to have lunch with me. It's a bit of a shame, because this man, Dr. Tony Cornell, for about 20 or 30 years, was the head ghost hunter in United Kingdom. He was the expert. If you look to any books, any reporting of ghosts in England, he would be the one who went there to investigate, to sit all night with his cameras and infrared gear trying to get the photo of these ghosts. And he was my personal friend. He used to have this business card he would hand out to his friends. Dr. Tony Cornell, Chief Ghost Hunter of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It was one cool business card. And it was true, he was. He wasn't making it up. So he had all the stories, all the research of what ghosts are really like. And know what they're like? They are totally safe. There was, at that time, I was investigating these things. As a student, I always liked interesting things like ghosts. Anything weird, I was into. And 100 years, I think, the anniversary of the London Society for Psychic Research, which started investigating ghosts. Now it's about 150 years. Never once has a ghost harmed anybody. This is one of the rules, one of the research facts which has been established over 150 years of scientific research in England, which is famous for its ghosts. A ghost has never once harmed a human being. And my friend Tony would say, you get a bottle like this flying past his ear, you get, interestingly, eggs inside a refrigerator going through the wall of the refrigerator. He's seen this flying right over his head and smashing in the wall behind him, but nothing ever hit. So because of that, you don't have to be afraid. These things go flying around, they're going to miss. Because that is the law, ghost law. So when you were in these forests and monasteries, any ghosts came up to you? As one did once. It was in Phupan mountain range of northeast Thailand. How long ago was this? It was about 30 years ago. And I was staying with a famous forest monk. And I was going to visit a town called Sokonakon, which was about 2 days' walk away. And I asked this monk, I asked him, are there any good places to stay halfway on the journey? Especially caves. Because I loved caves. They were so cool and quiet and great place to meditate. And he said, yes. There is a cave about halfway, but be careful, because there is a ghost in that cave. Now this came from one of the great forest monks, and of course they know what they're talking about. If he said there's a ghost there, I knew 100% a ghost would be there. So did I try and go somewhere else? I said, no! I want to meet this ghost. It's great to meet ghosts. You know, if you really wanted to be famous and make some money, it's hard economic times. Next time a ghost comes along, say, come over here and do an interview. You could have this published, you know, in the New Straits Times. It'll probably be syndicated. You might even get it in Time magazine or the New Yorker. Because how many people have done an in-depth interview with a ghost? You'd really want to ask some interesting questions, like, for example, do ghosts get married? Now, do they fall in love with a pretty female ghost? Do they have babies? Little baby ghosts? Where do they go to during the daytime? Because it seems they only come out at night. Where do they hang out? And what does it feel like to be a ghost when everybody is afraid of you? That must really do terrible things for your self-esteem. So, you're missing a great chance to have an in-depth interview with a real ghost and have it published in the most prestigious journals of the world. So actually, just I was interested in seeing a ghost again. So, I walked all day, and when I got to this village, it's a big town now. It's only a village, only just recently established. I said, where's the cave with the ghost? And one of the villagers said, I'll take you to it. And it was a very spooky cave. Because just under, deep down in the cave, there was a skeleton. And no one had removed that skeleton. It had been in there for I don't know how many years. And they had a little Buddha statue on a shrine. It was the cave this monk was talking about. The haunted cave of Phupan Mountain. Sounds good, doesn't it? Like a So then I set up my mosquito net and started meditating. Waiting for the ghost. Meditating and waiting. Meditating and waiting. And what happened? This stupid ghost never turned up. I was meditating away and it never came. So I don't know what time it was. I said, right, that's it, I'm turning in. So I lay down to sleep. And I'd just gone to sleep. When I was waking up, I was woken up because I heard the sound of someone running towards me and stopping right by my mosquito net. It was the ghost. You know, want to know what happened next? No, you're scared. Look, it's perfectly safe. What I said to that ghost, I said, you're too damn late. Get out of here. You should have come early. That's what I did. I sent it packing. Because, look, you've got to be firm with ghosts. Otherwise, they mess you around. If they can't keep appointments, send them packing. So, because you never had any fear, because you knew exactly what these things were. And I said to you a few days ago, these ghosts are lower beings, you're higher beings. It's just like I said, why is it an elephant is afraid of a mouse? Elephant's this big guy, can squash the mouse any time. It's exactly the same way, reason why you are afraid of ghosts. You can squash the ghost any time you want. You're much more powerful than that. So don't be afraid of ghosts. So as forest monks, we weren't afraid of these things because we had wisdom. We understood the nature of things. We understood that fear was just something which exaggerates the truth and really is no purpose at all in life. So as a forest monk, nature taught you these things. It taught you how to be fearless and how to just make peace with things and just not be afraid of hardly anything. But more than that, it taught you much about the stupidity of human beings and how you can become much wiser. Because I remember just walking with my teacher Ajahn Chah one day, and as he was walking in the forest, he picked up a branch of a tree. And he turned around to me and he said, Brahma Wangsa, Ajahn is teacher, so your teacher will never call you teacher. He said, Brahma Wangsa, is this branch heavy? Before I could answer, he threw it away. And he said, it's only heavy when you keep holding it. Now, there's a great teaching there. Things are only heavy if you keep grasping it. When you throw it away, what's the problem? So all the things you're worried about, all the things which stop you sleeping at night, all the problems of life, are they heavy? Only if you keep holding it. Chao Po is talking about the Bhikkhuni controversy. He says, Ajahn Brahm, you've been here for 9 days, all this stuff going on with you in the center of it, and you're just happy, teaching meditation, big deal. He said, it's easy because I don't hold it. You throw it away. It's only heavy when you keep holding it. Your cancer, is it heavy having cancer? Only if you keep holding it. Throw it away, stop worrying about it. If it's going to kill you, it's going to kill you. If you're going to survive, you're going to survive. Big deal. That's what my teacher told me once. I was in hospital with typhus fever, feeling terrible. Typhus fever like typhoid. You're drained of all energy, having these very high fevers. And the doctors didn't understand what I had. In fact, for all the time I was in hospital, no one understood what fever it was. It was only a few years later we discovered all those fevers which the Western monks had, typhus, scrub typhus. But one afternoon, Ajahn Chah walked into the monk's ward in Ubon Hospital. He came to visit me. This was this amazing teacher, the great monk, and he'd taken the time off just to visit me. Oh, you felt so proud and so happy. Now, it's like if some of you got sick and I took all the time off to come to the hospital ward and come and see you. You think, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're so kind. This has made my day. Thank you so much. But please don't invite me because I'll say the same thing Ajahn Chah told me. He came up to my bedside. I was really happy for a couple of seconds until he opened his mouth. He said, Brahma Wangsa, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. And then he left. Thank you very much. His bedside manner was not very good, but his wisdom was totally accurate. It's true. If you're sick in hospital, you're not going to stay there very long. You're either going to get better or you're going to die. Either way, you're out of there soon. And actually, that was quite comforting afterwards, because I really reflected on this forest wisdom. It was straight to the point, no messing around, teaching the truth of things, that sickness doesn't last. And actually, that was a teaching which I really valued. And of course, most of the time you get better, you get out. Sometimes you die, but you're going to die anyway. It's best to get it over and done with. Get it out of the way. So you can enjoy heaven. So whatever, these were some of the teachings. It's only heavy when you hold things. Now, how many people get stressed out in life? It's only because they hold on to things too long. So wherever you are, whatever you're doing, the amount of problems, difficulties, unfairness, financial difficulties, marital difficulties, health difficulties, they're not heavy at all, except when you keep holding them. So every now and again, throw them away and make peace. I'm not dead yet. I'm going to have a happy day. I'm not bankrupt today. I'm going to spend money. I'm not at work today, this evening. I'm going to enjoy this evening. If you can do that, you can understand how to be free of so much of the stress of life. And that's actually what we learned by living in the forest. But most importantly, the thing which made you a forest monk was the simplicity of your lifestyle. You just had very, very, very few possessions. One of the trainings we all had to do in those days, after 5 years of basic training, you know, where we learn how to meditate, we learn what the Buddha taught, we learn how to chant, we learn our rules and how to put on our robes and how to make robes and keep them clean. When we had our basic training of being a monk, then we all had to leave our monasteries and go walking on the streets of Thailand carrying everything we owned on our backs. We weren't allowed to leave any possessions in storage. You gave them away or you carried them. And you couldn't go in buses. You had to walk everywhere. Now when that came for me after my 5 years, I'd already got my possessions down to a minimum. But still, when you have to carry all those things, including your bowl and a little bag, umbrella with a mosquito net, it was still very heavy. After 2 or 3 days, it was amazing how many things I'd thrown away or given away. After 1 week, it was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life so far. All you had was a bowl with a spare robe. You had a water bottle and hardly any other possessions. And you knew in the morning, whatever village or town you reached, you could open your bowl and go on alms round and you'd get something to eat, even if it was only rice, enough to keep you going another day. Your mosquito net would give you a place to sleep at night in the jungle, in the fields, anywhere. And I had no responsibilities at all. All my possessions I was carrying, and they were so light. I could go to any crossroads, and I could turn left, right, go straight ahead, or turn around. I had no appointments, no schedule, no place to go. I was really homeless. And you felt as free as a bird, carrying, as the Buddha said, only the weight of their wings. I just had the bowl and robe and mosquito net was all I was carrying. And with such few possessions, never again have I ever felt so free, so weightless, walking through the streets, the jungle paths of Thailand. It was one of the most blissful times of my life. And it taught me what many of you know. It's not that you own your possessions. Possessions own you. It's the case, the more you have, the more you have to carry in life. And the fewer things you have, the more free you feel. So those of you who have wealth, put it in investment accounts. Don't put it in property and things. Because you feel, find all those possessions and things will be a great burden for you. Things to worry about, things to keep, to guard. When you have few things, wow, you're as free as a bird. And that was an important teaching for us, just to show how little you needed to survive. All you need is a place to stay at night, food for your belly, clothes to wear, and medicines in time of sickness. We are taught about the four requisites. And as long as you have those, you're not poor. If you've got a place to stay, clothes for your body, food for your belly, and medicines in time of sickness, that's enough. Everything else is extra, but not that necessary. Now, for those of you who think about security, putting stuff aside for your future, how many of you lost money in the stock market crash? So much for putting things aside for the future. Investments are uncertain. If they're investments in stock markets, property, businesses, but the investment in what I call social capital, your friends and family, communities, even temples and churches, those sorts of investments are called investments in social capital, in friendship. Because that friendship, if you invest in that, that will always be there for you. And that is something which is worth so much in times of trouble, in sickness, in financial calamity, in old age. What is there to support you in your old age? Even more than your investments, it is your family and friends. That is what will keep you stable. That is what will get you out of calamities and difficulties. If you're going to invest in anything in life, invest in your family and friends, in your community, social capital. And of course, being a monk, that was my strength. Wherever I went, I had food to eat. I had friends to look after me in case I was sick. And so it's a wonderful lifestyle where the investment was not in things, but in people, in kindness and in goodness. And you felt so free when you were investing in things which you could rely upon. And so, traveling those lands, you'd meet great teachers, and you'd learn from all those different teachers, and you'd find places of great solitude, because sometimes we live in such a busy world, it's so hard to find peace, time for yourselves. Even though I'm a busy monk, travel and teach, I do spend a lot of time by myself in solitude. A few years ago, I spent 6 months without speaking to any human being. 6 month retreat without seeing a human being. Could you do that? Would that send you mad? Some of my supporters thought I was going to go mad. They were expecting me to see me when I came out of retreat with long hair and crazy eyes. And they were very disappointed. Actually, they were very happy because after you came out, incredible energy. I was staying in one of the huts in the forest. And as soon as I came out, I'd been meditating for 6 months, not speaking or doing anything. Oh, that was really nice meditation. And the other monks in my monastery, they were trying to be the next monk to stay in that hut, you know, to get some of the energy for themselves. And one of the monks, he sort of won the competition, or he managed to persuade all the other monks to let him go in there the next day. And he tried to go in, he couldn't go in. He couldn't go in the door. The energy was too great for him. That's what happens when you're in solitude. You have to wait for a couple of days for it to cool down a bit, energy wise. So you have these incredible, powerful, beautiful, silent places. But you know, every time I was silent, every time I was by myself in the mountains or jungles or deep caves, once I remember asking myself, how come you're not lonely? How come you don't miss talking to somebody? How come you don't miss no sharing jokes or stories with others? And I realized something important. I was not alone. Someone else was there with me. You know who that was? Me. I was there. And I realized wherever you go in life, there's always someone there. Me. And you know, over the years of being a monk, I had got to like myself. I was kind to myself. I had, as I said in the book, opened the door of my heart to myself and accepted me for who I was. So I was my best friend. And because I had got to love and accept to make peace with myself, wherever I went, even if there was no one else there, I was always with my best friend, me. And that taught me a lot about why people are lonely in life. The reason you're lonely is not because there's no one else there. The reason people are lonely is because they don't like themselves. They're not at peace with themselves. So when no one else is around, you're with your enemy, yourself. And it taught me how important it is, how essential in life is to get a proper relationship with yourself, a sense of being at peace, understanding, acceptance, and not being so fault-finding with all of your mistakes you've made in life. Which is why, to understand what I mean, I gave that simile in one of my books, Opening the Door of Your Heart. For each one of you, sooner the better, when you're alone, to look at yourself, and with a leap of faith, of hope, of wisdom, to say to yourself, with 100% sincerity, whoever I am, whatever I have done, good and bad, the door of my own heart is open to me. Come in. To give yourself unconditional acceptance, respect, and love. I don't mean just loving the nice part of yourself, the stuff which you can be proud of. I mean loving the whole of yourself, even the bad part. That is also part of you. And if you can't allow that in, there is no chance for healing, no chance for peace. And of course, I did that a long time ago. Opened the door of my heart to myself with all of my good qualities and all of my stupid qualities. You know one of my worst stupid qualities? Always telling bad jokes. Do you want to hear a bad joke? Here's a terrible joke. Got nothing to do with the talk, but it's funny. There were these two men standing on top of a cliff. One had a canary in a cage. The other had a parrot on his shoulder. And they looked at each other. And the man with the canary, with the budgerigar in the cage, jumped off the cliff. And it was about 100 meters drop. And he was hurtling to his certain death. And the budgie in the cave realized that if it didn't do anything, they would both die. So the budgie started flapping its wings. It's only a small budgie. It needs to flap hard enough to lift not just itself and the cage, but the man as well. And so it was flapping as hard as it could. Still nothing was happening. So it flapped even harder. It flapped as hard as a canary has ever flapped its wings. And of course something started to happen. The man started to slow down because of the budgie trying to fly. And the budgie flapped harder and harder. He slowed down even further. And just as he reached the bottom, all the man needed to do is bend his legs a little bit to take the momentum of the fall. and the budgie had saved him. And the poor budgie, having flapped so hard, was lying on his back, panting. Oh, that budgie was tired. And the second man, with a parrot on his shoulder. Then it was his turn to jump. And when he jumped, the parrot refused to flap at all. So the guy got out a gun and shot the parrot dead. He shot the parrot. And as soon as he killed the parrot, the man started slowing down. It was like magic. It was like a miracle. And when that man got to the bottom there, he didn't even need to bend his legs. His fall was just so light. And having both survived the jump, they looked at each other. And the first man with the budgie, just about recovering, said, "This budgie jumping is very good, but not as good as parrot shooting." So that's one of my faults. I just stupid jumps. And I'm not sure if you hear any jokes in other Buddhist talks in temples in Malaysia. But anyhow, so a long time ago, I accepted myself who I was, with stupid jokes and all. I made peace with myself. And so because I made peace with myself, because I showed myself love and acceptance, that's where wherever I go in this world, I'm always with my best friend. With me. Which means you never feel lonely. And also, because all that solitude which I practiced and I learned to make peace with myself, it means you're never restless when you're by yourself. You're never looking for distractions, something to do. So I like my own company. But if you learn to like your own company, you find then you can like the company of others. It's a wonderful thing. As this forest monk, you spend all this time by yourself, and in the evening you come around for a nice cup of tea with your friends, enjoying each other's company. And even the most serious monks, you know, you've heard, you know, like people like Ajahn Chah, even Ajahn Mun was a bundle of laughs. Some of these monks you think are so serious. Yeah, they are serious in front of you guys, in front of the lay people. But you get the monks by themselves and have a great time. Why? Because there's a time for practicing and being serious. There's a time for being light-hearted. And really, if you're free, if you feel at peace, you get very light-hearted. So the great monks I knew could laugh at little things and they never get angry at big things, which is a sign of their wisdom, a true forest monk. Who could smile at the smallest things, but never frown. Why? Because they let go of all these burdens. And they could enjoy the moment, and then let it go. So often, you know, you saw these great forest monks being such wonderful people to be around. Not just wise, but ever so kind and caring for you. Always ready to cheer you up with a funny story. I'll give you a very deep teaching. So, I've gone on already too far, 9:05, with Tales of a Forest Monk. So we'll call this Tales of a Forest Monk Part 1. And Part 2 will be next year when I come back to Penang for another retreat in December 2010. Thank you for listening. Okay, there's lots of questions here, and that's one of the reasons why I stopped a bit early. And first of all, the questions from yesterday. Okay, dear Ajahn, oh, it's a bhikkhuni question. What's the difference between a bhikkhuni and a mechi? A mechi is one of the nuns, especially in Thailand. They keep 8 precepts, just like the people doing meditation have been keeping, and they wear white. Sometimes they shave their hair, sometimes they don't. So, it's not the full ordination. Bhikkhu is a full ordination. In the time of the Buddha, you had the bhikkhus, which were the monks, the bhikkhunis were the nuns, and the upasakas were the laymen, upasikas were the lay women. It was called the fourfold assembly. And the Buddha After his enlightenment, Mara said, no need to teach, you know, you're enlightened, I accept that, you know, get out of here. And the Buddha said, no, I will not enter Parinibbana, I'll not leave until I've established the fourfold assembly. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, lay men, lay women. So that's it. It was the intention of the Buddha from the very beginning of his teaching career to establish the female monastic order, the male monastic order, the female lay people, the male lay people. So from the very beginning, the Buddha was so much ahead of his time, giving equity for everybody. And if you don't believe that, go and look at some of the old teachings of the Buddha in the suttas. I was encouraging people to have a read of two particular groups of ancient Buddha's teachings, the Theragata and the Therigata, which are the verses of the enlightened monks and also the verses of the enlightened nuns. There were enlightened bhikkhunis and enlightened bhikkhus in the time of the Buddha. It was actually pretty even. And so that meant that it was in the beginning. We've lost it a little bit over many hundreds of years, but we've actually found out a way to revive it again, and that's what I was participating in Perth. It's got me in a bit of trouble for the time being, but I'm sure after a while people will see the benefit of this, as most people do. But it's really worthwhile in our modern age of having equity. In other words, treating male and female totally equally and giving advantages to both. Meiji don't get the same respect or chances for practice as bhikkhus do. Just go to Thailand and see. So we're trying to get equality, having monks and nuns. So if you see some of the bhikkhunis, which I helped ordain, they look just like me, bit of a darker robe, so they can tell who's a male and female, so they know which toilet to go into. For practical reasons, darker robe, lighter robe. Other than that, they look exactly the same, treated totally fairly. In our modern age, we have to do that. How do you separate the sufferer from the suffering? Okay, if you are suffering, you have a bit of a pain. Number one, it's not going to last. So it doesn't matter how bad it is, you know it's only going to be temporary. And that's one of the wonderful things to know, because really, if you look at it deeply, all suffering is just a pause between two moments of happiness. And all happiness is a pause between two moments of suffering. It is the nature of our life to have suffering and then happiness, and suffering and happiness. Just like waves on the ocean, up and down. And the weird thing is that even if the tide goes up, so you have, we'd expect more happiness, still we have happiness and suffering. Look at your lifestyle. You live like kings and queens, every one of you. I'm talking about kings and queens 100, 200 years ago. If you got the... Did Penang have a sultan? Well, say if you get the sultan of Johor or something, 200 years ago, he couldn't watch movies at just the flick of a button. He couldn't watch dancing on the TV from whatever country of the world. He couldn't eat such a great variety of food. Even the food we get every day in this temple is a banquet fit for a king. You look at the food here and compare what people would eat 100 years ago. I'm talking about rich people, kings and queens. The clothes you wear, the cars, the travel. Really, our wealth, our entertainment, our food, our health is increased so much. You'd think you'd be happy. If you took a person 100 years ago and put him in this island today, they would think this is heaven. But Jan is still not happy, because sometimes it's not the right movie on TV. Sometimes the food was not quite as delicious as you ate yesterday. Because our happiness and suffering is all related to what just went before and what's coming up next. So suffering, it will always be there, but you know it's going to be replaced by happiness soon. Even in extreme places of suffering, such as Auschwitz during the Second World War, you think, how on earth could people have happiness in a place where they're about to be gassed to death? But if you read accounts of people who lived through that place, there were days when they had jokes, when they shared a good laugh. There was happiness, and even in those places. It's a weird thing, but in any situation, you'd always find happiness, you'd always find suffering. It's part of life. No one, not even the Buddha, can avoid all suffering. That's why we leave samsara, to get rid of suffering. In this world, we'll have a fair share of happiness and suffering. So if you're having a bad time, don't worry, it will pass. More importantly, if you're happy, be careful, because that's passing too. So enjoy it while you have it. Learn from it, make the use of it, guard it. Because whatever happiness and prosperity and good family you have, do not take it for granted. It's unstable. So care for it. But with separating the sufferer from the suffering, you realize, what's suffering? What is hurting? Is it my body hurting? Or is it I am hurting? A lot of times it's you're making the pain by not wanting it. It's what we call the difference between mental pain and physical pain. And the mental pain is, I don't want to hurt. I don't want to have a headache. I don't want to be poor. It's all that mental pain of moaning and groaning. As for monk, I love being poor. I really recommend it. Just be poor, like me, have nothing, and then you're free. Don't have to worry about tax man, don't have to ask for any... Anyway, I'll leave that alone. If someone has faith in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, one is a stream winner. If have faith in Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha... Oh, I have faith in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, but I'm not sure whether I'm already a stream winner. Is there any way to know for sure? What qualities as Dhamma talk? I don't know. Anyway, if you're not sure whether you're a stream winner or not, you're not a stream winner. Because you have to have certain faith, awaita prasada. So if you're not sure whether you're a stream winner, you're not. If you're sure you're a stream winner, you're conceited. You can't win. So, a stream winner, there is an event which happens. A stream winner is an experience. That's why, in the monk's vinaya, this is a monastic rule. There's a questionnaire which you ask people. So if anyone comes up in the stream winner, there's a certain group of questions I will ask you to see if you qualify or not. And if you make one mistake, half a mistake, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. All it is actually to see whether, you know, you really have got it or not. At least sometimes you can prove you're not, but sometimes you think you are when you're not. I don't know, the last time I told you about when I got enlightened, I'm now going to tell you the story when I got enlightened. Do you want to hear it? This is a great story of a forest monk. This was in a jungle monastery, again in the northeast of Thailand. It was my fourth year as a monk, and my meditation was going really well. You know that sometimes you meditate, you go in this purple spot. You can meditate really well and deeply, you've got no defilements, no hindrances, and everything's really great. And it's one of those purple times. Everything was really smooth, good health, inspired. And one evening, I was walking meditation, the mind was really still, and all these insights, you don't go chasing insights, they come to you. And all these amazing truths were coming up, bigger, more profound, until the big one came. The big one. And wow, that really hit me. I remember the time, I remember the place on this walking path in this remote jungle monastery in northeast Thailand. That was it. At last, after all these years of practice, there was another enlightened being in the world. Oh, that felt good. That felt, you don't realize how wonderful it feels to be enlightened. The problem was, it didn't last very long. Because what happened? I was so energized, so peaceful, so wise, everything, just insights just poured in. And you weren't sleepy. No way did I feel like laying down, but I did go back to my hut for half an hour, didn't go asleep, you just lay down perfectly mindful. No sloth and torpor at all. And in this monastery, we get up at 3 o'clock. 2:30 I was in the hall meditating. And often in that hall at 3 o'clock in the morning, hot, humid, you'd be quite sleepy. I was perfectly alert. Effortless mindfulness. The chanting, powerful, smooth, and then we went on arms round. And on our arms round, I was thinking, these people putting food in my bowl, they don't know how lucky they are giving food to a newly enlightened monk. They are so lucky. And when we got back to the monastery after alms round, we only get rice in the alms bowl. It's a very poor part of the world. Maybe a banana if we're lucky. And usually for food, with our rice, the villagers would cook one pot of curry. And that curry was always the same. Rotten fish curry. Now it really was rotten fish. And to explain what I mean, what the villagers would do during the rainy season, the monsoon season, they'd catch fish, they'd eat most of them, and then they'd, what was left over, because they had heaps of fish that time, they'd put in an earthen jar, just bung it in the jar, and just put a piece of plastic on top and wait for it to ferment. Now I remember in one other monastery, I was cleaning up around the kitchen, I found such a jar, because the plastic had had a hole in it, and so the flies had got in and it was crawling with maggots. And it stank, as you expect it would. And so I got it up and I picked it up and went to throw it away. But as it happened, the head man of the village was visiting. And he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Look, it's gone off. Maggots all over it." And the head man said, the most educated man in the whole village, said, "Give it to me, that's just extra protein." And the following day, we had rotten fish curry again. Now, it stank. And it tasted just as bad. But that's all you had. Rotten fish curry. Day after day after day. You never really got used to it, but you had no choice. But this day, this morning, after my enlightenment, there were two pots of curry. Now, the second pot of curry was a pork curry. Now, for those of you who think, aren't monks vegetarian? I used to be a vegetarian before I became a monk. There just wasn't vegetables in that part of the world. There wasn't sort of carrots or beans or mushrooms. It was just whatever crawled or slithered got put in a pot and that's what you ate. It was basic stuff. But today, there was a pork curry, and that was delicious. When I saw it, I thought, ah, the heavenly beings have noticed I'm enlightened, and they are celebrating another enlightened man in this world. I thought, that makes sense. But in the temple, there was a number of monks, about six of us. And because I was four reigns, I was actually the second monk. And the teacher was about 20 or 30 monks. He was a local boy, who'd ordained and then went to see Ajahn Chah, trained with him, and then set up this monastery where I was staying. Now this was a local boy, who'd been grown up with rotten fish curry. So, he would sort of like it. It's this local delicacy. me sort of coming from England, you know, it tasted like, you know, what comes out of the backside of somebody. But I thought, today I'm going to have a good meal. So the head monk, he chose his first. And I couldn't believe how many ladles of this pork curry he put in his bowl. 3 whopping big ladles. And straight away I thought, the pig. Because he was greedy. You can't deny that. He took far too much than he can eat. But I didn't really worry, because there was plenty of pork curry left for me. But then, do you know what this pig of an abbot did? He took hold of the pork curry, the whole pot, and he poured it into the rotten fish curry. And he stirred it all up. This is true. And he said as he stirred it up, "It's all the same, it's all the same." And I thought, bloody hypocrite, if it was all the same, why did you take out yours first before you mixed it up? And I was so pissed off at this monk. I was really angry. He spoiled my one meal of the day. And that's when I remembered, enlightened monks don't get pissed off. And I was. And I realized I wasn't enlightened after all. That was worse than eating rotten fish curry. And you know what, I didn't care what I ate, I slopped it in because I was so depressed. There's nothing spoils your day more than thinking you're enlightened and finding you're not. So that's the story of my life. It was a false enlightenment, but it felt like it at the time. So, even if you think you're a stream winner, be careful. Get someone to mix up your favourite food with stuff you hate and eat it, and then you'll find out if you're enlightened or not. Ajahn Brahm, here we are encouraged by Ajahn to practice letting go. It is also usual that we are encouraged to make aspiration. Is there a contradiction there? Thank you, Ajahn. Aspiration is what we call it's the second of the 4 spirations. Because you start with inspiration. That's the first of the spirations. Inspiration. You know, when you listen to a talk and you get really interested and encouraged, and then afterwards you go to the second spiration, which is aspiration. When you think, wow, this is really good, this is really easy, I'm going to do this, I'm going to meditate, I'm going to keep precepts. That's the aspiration. And then you go on pretty quickly to the third spiration, which is desperation. Where you realize how hard it is to meditate or to keep precepts or be compassionate. And of course you end with the last spiration, expiration, when you give up. The 4 spirations, and aspiration is number 2. So be careful, because aspiration can actually lead to a lot of frustration. You want, you aspire to, but really, what do you really want in life? What are you aspiring towards? Isn't it true you have everything you need already? As one wise person once said, this is for you lay people, every minute you want more money means that minute you can't enjoy what you already have. Every minute you want some more money, in that minute you can't enjoy the money you already have. Because when you want, you're working again. If you can just spend a minute or two every day just enjoying what you already have and not wanting anything more, then you'll know how to meditate. It's okay to want, to work, to gain wealth, but don't do it 24 hours every day of your life. Spend a few moments stopping and enjoying all that you've accumulated through your hard work, through your sweat, through your energy. Stop and don't want for anything for 5 minutes, so you can enjoy what you've already made. Every minute you want more money means in that minute you can't enjoy what you've already earned. Think about it. I thought it was really good. So let go. You've aspired too much. Ajahn, is the choice of religion depends on one's karma, so there's no point to convert or force someone to stay in a certain religion. It's your karma to be converted. No, it's not. Is it your karma that you're in one particular religion and not another religion? Look, we live in a wonderful age of choice. You can go to supermarkets and you have all the different choices. You can have rice from every country in the world. You don't have to eat local rice anymore. You can have Western food, Chinese food, Indian food, any food. You have choice. So in the supermarkets of religion, now you can choose. And sometimes people make a buffet of so many different religions. A bit of Buddhism, a bit of Christianity, a bit of Islam here, a bit of something else there. Is that okay? If it's truth, if it works, fine. For me, there are only two types of religion in this world. The first religion you'll find in this world is people who bend the truth to fit their beliefs. And the other one, they bend their beliefs to fit the truth. Which one do you want to follow? Do you want to have beliefs? Doesn't matter what the truth says, you'll bend the truth to fit your beliefs. Or are you one who's courageous enough to bend your beliefs, even to throw them away, to fit the truth? Real Buddhism, real religion, will be someone or a practice where you will not have any sacred cows. Any beliefs, any dogma, you're willing to change if truth proves otherwise. And that really is the only two religions in the world. Those who bend the truth to fit their belief, or bend the belief to fit the truth. And that's, you can't say Buddhism is one or the other. Because there's some Buddhists, some parts of Buddhism, which, like every other, they bend the truth to fit their belief. But the Buddhism which I like, Christianity, Islam, whatever, which I like, is that which will bend the belief to fit the truth. The truth is paramount, not the beliefs. Doesn't matter what it says in the books. It's what it says in the heart is more important. So, I invite you to choose that religion. What do we chant or reflect before we have our meal? Christians and Muslims each have their own prayers. What about us? And someone actually was asked, do you pray before you eat your mother's lunch? And he says, no, because my mother's a good cook. If your mother's not a good cook, you better do some praying. Now you can chant whatever you like. In retreat, I heard that my roommate said I was talking while I was sleeping in night time. Is it because of keeping noble silence in daytime? You talk at night time, you get sort of a balance. No, because that person who's in your room doesn't know how to let go, and they're still hearing things. So it doesn't matter if you're sleeping during night time and you talk during the night time. Really, get a recorder and see what they say. Because night time, because it's in a dream state, sometimes very psychic things happen. See if they say any numbers. You never know. It might be really interesting. No, sometimes people they talk in their sleep. And sometimes it may be because there's some sort of tension or agitation. And that's when it comes out in talking. Dear Ajahn Brahm, which of the following is best? To become a monk, to become master of meditation, or both of the above? Okay, I think they're equally good. So it's great to become a monk or a nun. It's one of the best lifestyles you could ever have. And I want to do this because you know in universities they have careers days? really, that you should get a Buddhist store in Korea's days. Become a monk. It's a great lifestyle. The pay is not good, but the retirement is out of this world. And you have a lot of fun. You know, one of the reasons why I became a monk and stay as a monk, because I was at university, I was Cambridge, and the world was at my feet, sort of. And I thought, what sort of career should I have? And I realized, I thought it out, whatever I do in life has to fulfill two things. Personal fulfillment, happiness, was important. Whatever I did in my life, I had to be happy. But secondly, that wasn't enough just to be happy myself. The second thing which I had to fulfill was be able to give happiness to others, to make a contribution to this world, to lessen pain or suffering or problems. So I had to find a career which gave me personal happiness and which could share happiness to others. And my goodness, I hit the jackpot being a monk. There's no other life can give you such personal happiness. And you've seen me, you know that. And there's no other life which can help other people so much. There's, I don't know how many people in my life as a monk have come up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, you have saved my life. If it wasn't for you, I'd be dead. Many have said that. For those of you who see the latest edition of that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, I had to do a new preface for it. And so, just when I was asked to do a new preface, the week before, a woman had visited me in Australia. She came and said she travelled all the way from Bern in Switzerland, not to visit Perth, but just to see me. That was the whole purpose of her trip. And she was so lucky and so happy that I was actually there at the time. And she told me her story. She had panic attack, anxiety disorder, cancer. She was a physical and mental wreck. Her doctor and psychiatrist were trying to heal her, and it was a psychiatrist gave her a copy of the German edition of my book. That Opening the Door of Your Heart, what you see in the back there is the American version, Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? It's in about 18 or 19 languages now, including Braille. And she had the German copy, which was a bestseller done by Random House in Germany. And she got a copy of that book, and within a couple of months, she was off all her medication, cancer gone. She had her life back. And this is no exaggeration. And she came to me just to say thank you. She had the beaten up copy of her book, very well used. And she said, Ajahn Brahm, will you please sign it for me? And of course I signed those books. And as soon as I started signing it, she started weeping. She just wanted to say thank you because I had saved her life, literally. Now if you do that once, can you imagine how much happiness you feel? If you do that, I don't know how many, 100, 200, 300 times, you imagine how fulfilling your life is. So I achieved my objectives in life many times over. Your own personal happiness and be able to help other people. As a doctor, you can help a few people. But as a monk, you help thousands. And not just superficially, right to their very core. So if you're looking for a career, come up afterwards and I'll shave your hair. So it's great being a monk, great being a master of meditation, both of us. I have a friend who terminated her pregnancy and she's having occasional nightmares, like the child asking her why she killed him to solve this problem. If you do terminate a pregnancy and have an abortion, there was a being who almost had enough karma to get into this world and for one reason or another stopped. Now you don't need to feel so bad about that child because of what happened to them. Literally, according to the scheme of things, they get priority into the next vacant womb. Just like if you're traveling on Malaysian Airlines and you find they've overbooked the flight, and you get bumped off, You know, you can't board that flight. What happens? You get priority on the next available flight and also usually an upgrade. So that's usually what happens if you have an abortion. That child gets priority on the next available flight into this human realm, and they often they get an upgrade too. Now, that's a nice way of putting it. That's often what happens. The kid hasn't done anything wrong. It's just been an unfortunate situation. So they get a bit of an extra there. So don't worry too much that you've stopped that kid having a human life. They'll have another try very soon as well. And a lot of times, and I've said this, what right does a monk, a priest, an imam have of telling you whether it's right or wrong to have an abortion? I am a man. I've never been pregnant. So what do I know of what you're going through? And I mean that because sometimes other people will criticize you. They may even judge you and say good or bad. What do they know what you're feeling and why you made that decision? Maybe only other people who face the decision to abort or not, only they can judge you, because only they can understand. Unfortunately, many people who pronounce on the ethical right or wrong of having an abortion are usually, almost always, men. Disregard what they say. Feel in your heart why you've done this, what you've done. And all the women I've talked to who've had abortions, it has been one of the most difficult decisions they've ever made in their life, if not the most difficult decision. And they haven't done this with a bad intention. They haven't been heedless and rushed. They've thought, considered, soul-searched, and they're trying to do the best for everybody. And because of that, whatever karma they've done is very small. Intention is the most important part of your karma. And you should never ever equate the decision to have an abortion with the same decision to kill a human being, a fully grown up human being. The abortion is a complicated situation and should be treated as a special case, not equivalent to all other acts of killing a human being. It's a special case. So those of you who've had that abortion, cut yourself some slack. Don't believe what the men say. You know you've tried to do the best decision. Accept what you've done, forgive it, learn, and don't allow that to cause you pain. Anyway, that's what I say. A man. I have a few friends working and doing business who confess to me that whatever hard-earned money, bonus, windfall from lottery, they can't save, because whenever they have the extra money, a lot of unexpected expenses come, such as car repairs, sick, roof leak, unexpected bills to pay. Is it bad karma, or they just got to live with it? You will never have enough money. If you win at the lottery, have you ever seen the reports? Everyone who wins at the lottery buys a ticket the next week. It's well known. Why do they do that? They've just won a few million. Because they like to have a few more million. Who's the richest man in Malaysia? Are they retired or are they still working 7 days a week? You notice just the more money you have, the harder you have to work. The less money you have, the less hard you have to work. There's a story in my book called The Story of the Mexican Fisherman. There was a professor from the United States who was on holiday in Mexico, on the coast of the Caribbean, in this beautiful fishing village. And he was just walking around just before lunch. He went to the pier and he saw a fishing boat coming in. And he watched the old fisherman unload his catch. And he decided to have a conversation with him. He said, Signor, what are you doing? He said, oh, I've been out all morning. I've caught enough fish, to sell, to feed my family, to look after my finances. Now I'm going to have lunch with my wife. And after lunch with my wife, I'm going to have a siesta. A couple of hours snooze after lunch. Really nice. In the afternoon, I'll be there when my kids come home from school. Play with them. Spend time with them. And in the evening, I'm going to the cantina. Now have a tiny bit of tequila, play guitar, and hang out with my friends. Now life is good. And the professor said, that's really stupid. Look, I am a professor of business studies from a prestigious business school in the US. I'm on vacation down here. I can give you some free advice. Don't be so lazy. Go and have lunch, but take your boat out in the afternoon. And then you're exploiting to the max your resources. Why leave an empty boat unused in the afternoon? And that way you'll probably catch twice as many fish. With the extra profit over a few years, or a few months even, you'll be able to buy a bigger boat with crew. Now once you have other people working for you in a bigger boat, you'll find the number of fish you catch goes up exponentially. In maybe another year, you'll be able to buy your second boat and have a bigger crew. In about 6 or 7 years, you'll have a whole fleet of fishing boats. Imagine how much money you'll make then. Now then you should move your business headquarters to Mexico City, or even better, to LA. And once you've moved your business headquarters to LA, you can diversify, float your company on the stock market, give yourself share options, do a company buyback, and after a while you'll be a multimillionaire. So that's how it's done. So I'm a professor, I know these things. And the fisherman was listening patiently, and he said, but Signor, once I've got all those many millions of dollars, then what would I do? And the professor never thought it out that far. Now he stopped when you were a millionaire, never realized, what do you do next? It's a question no one ever asked him in business school, so he thought for a little while and said, yeah, well look, once you're a millionaire, you can retire. That's what you do when you've got plenty of money. You can retire to a nice fishing village like this. You can get yourself a little boat and go out every morning for fun. You'll be able to have lunch with your wife every day and sleep after lunch. You'll be able to be there to play with your kids after they come home from school. You can always go out without any stress to the cantina to play guitar and hang out with your friends. Yeah, that's what you do when you retire. I do that already, Signor. Why is it they all try to be rich so we can retire and live like a poor person? Think about it. Ajahn Brahm, can you enlighten me? Is it true that people become wealthy through illegal means such as selling drugs, organized gambling, money lending, frequently give donations to temples to lessen their sinful acts? They don't give donations to my temples. Now that sometimes, obviously, as Buddhists, we don't condone, encourage anything illegal. If money is not well earned, it's going to cause you a lot of problems sooner or later. However, a wonderful thing is that if someone wants to give a donation, a charity, as a monk you don't worry where it comes from. If there is from illegal means, you have to accept that charity simply because you encourage donations, charity, generosity more than anything else. So you have to give even crooks a chance to be generous, to make good karma. So that was actually a strange saying, but I understood it, that you're not condoning that activity, but you're offering the person a chance to make some good karma, to feel good about themselves. And the very first year I was in Thailand, the first weeks I was in Thailand, I was surprised at first. But then I thought, when I was explained to me, what a wonderful Buddhist thing this is. Because in Patpong Road in Bangkok, the red light district where all the brothels and bars and nightclubs were, once a year the Buddhist monks would go to one of those brothels not for sex. They'd go there to do some chanting, to receive the meal, and give those prostitutes a blessing. They would clean the place up that one day a year, and the monks would not look down upon those girls. Why they were in that profession, this was the one day of the year they wanted to do good karma, to make merit. And the monks were humble enough to actually to go there and allow the girls to make merit. They were so non-judgmental. And when I heard that, I thought, this Buddhism is just amazing, just how wise it can be. Because sometimes people get in that profession, I can't judge them, I don't know what choices they have, if they have choices. You don't encourage it, you don't condone it, but it exists. But at least the monks aren't that superior to say, I'm not going to go and touch people like you or go to your place. They allow them to have one day a year when they can be good Buddhists, feel proud of themselves, have self-esteem, and do something kind and good. Maybe hearing some Dhamma. I thought it was really neat. I don't know if you agree with me, but I thought it was great. Good. So, sometimes you don't condone organized gambling and these other things, but at least allow them to do some good. I read from a newspaper there was a teenage boy met with an accident and went into a coma. The doctor certified that his brain is dead. Within a short while, the boy's father was asked to donate his son's heart to a girl patient who was in a critical situation. Due to the urgencies, the boy's father has agreed to pull the oxygen tube off without asking the boy's mother and didn't check out the boy's willingness. The heart has been transplanted successfully to the girl, but after the operation, the boy's father regretted on his rash decision. Also, his wife was blaming him for making the decision without her consent. The boy's father asked in tears whether his decision is right or whether he's killed his own son. What is your thought on this? Thank you. Modern medicine is so good now, they can know with 100% certainty whether that death is irreversible. The organs are harvested just at that point where the death is irreversible. The person will not be able to feel that heart being taken out. It won't be of any use to them. At the very worst, it's just hastening the death by a minute or so. So number one, that both parents know that death was inevitable. You haven't killed your son. In fact, you've allowed your son to make greater merits by allowing them to give the organs to someone else. That son was 100% certain to die. Now someone else is maybe 80-90% certain to live by having a donated heart. What is bad about that? You've saved someone's life. All that parents need to do is ask someone who has actually had a heart transplant from someone else. If they go and speak to a recipient of a heart transplant, not maybe their son's heart, but someone else's heart, they will feel what a wonderful thing that was, what a great decision that was. You've saved a life, given a mother back to their children who would die without their heart. You've done a great good act. Well done. So you haven't killed your son. You saved the life of someone who got your son's heart. Your son was going to die anyway. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when the students misbehaved according to the discipline procedure in school, the student was caned. Is it bad karma to cane someone? I think somebody asked this in the interviews. It's a tough one. It's better if there wasn't canes, because the Buddha said, to put aside the cane and try and find other ways to discipline kids. The reason is because when I was punished, what I learned at school was just to not get caught next time. I never learned why I was being punished. It's just I was stupid to be one of the kids who was caught instead of the other ones who were much smarter than me and got off. So sometimes make sure if there's any punishment, you know why and the lessons being learned. You're not punishing to make people feel more pain, not out of revenge. All punishment should be to try and make sure that miscreant never does it again. It's like rehabilitation. It's getting rid of the problem, making sure that nothing like that happens again. It's not revenge. It's not you hurt someone else, therefore I have to hurt you. So the pain part of punishment is something which I don't agree with. It's like a teaching, helping, making sure the problem is solved, it never happens again. That is something which I do agree with. So when people do something wrong, we're not trying to punish them from their past. If we are using punishment, it's to make sure they have a better, well-behaved future. Where there's alternatives to the cane, I think there probably is. However, this is Malaysia, and the person I think who asked this question is one of the discipline teachers in the school, and she's in a difficult situation because all the other teachers use the cane. If she doesn't, she would get exploited by some of those kids. They won't understand what's going on. If you're in a school like that, if you join the school, you have to, as a teacher, as a student, you have to keep the rules of that school. If they use the cane, you have to be prepared to use it. If you don't like doing that, go to another school which doesn't use it. Or try and find other methods so everybody agrees not to use the cane and find other ways of sorting out the problems of discipline in schools. Because sometimes it takes a lot to find out why a kid is misbehaving. Why did you do that? And it's more important to find out the reasons and solve those reasons rather than thinking you misbehaved, bend over and giving a whacking, and the kid doesn't really understand why they're being punished. And sometimes they think just the world is a cruel place, no one understands them. I don't know, that's a tough question to ask, but I don't know if I've answered it enough relevantly, but anyway. A recent analogy: would you release a wild man eating tiger in a street full of people? And that tiger only kills for food or on provocation. Under these circumstances, isn't the criminal justice system and law enforcement the lesser of evils to be tolerated? Surely it is too much to expect society to be willing or able to build sanctuaries for wild animals or undesirable elements. I think what you mean there is, in a justice system, if somebody is, say, a killer, they can harm other people, you know, what should you do to them? Again, in justice systems, I never think that punishment works. Rehabilitation should work. So if a person is a danger to themselves or others, then the jail system should be looked upon as quarantine, so that they don't harm other people, don't harm themselves, until the reason why they're killing, hurting, raping, beating people up is solved. It's a psychological problem, it's a mental illness, and like many other illnesses, it can be healed with proper therapy. However, if we put a person inside a jail and punish them, sometimes the jail term expires, they're still not healed, which means then they're released into society and they create all sorts of mischief again. The justice system, rather the prison system in so many countries, is a breaking point. It's known it doesn't work, but no one's got any better ideas. That's why we keep on having prisons. And we all know that prisons are just universities of crime. You just learn how to be a better criminal when you go in there. And the people who go in, they come out and they go back in again. Basically, I've seen that it's not a really good system. Another system is seeing like crime as a sickness, as an illness, put them inside for quarantine with psychologists, health professionals or whatever, to try and make sure that they are treated so they don't ever feel like killing or being violent or raping or doing those things ever again. Treating it as an illness rather than something to be punished. And to be in that system as long as it takes for them to be safe enough to be released into public. In the same way, a person who has some terrible disease which is contagious, like SARS, H1N1, you put them in quarantine, you keep them in there for as long as it takes for the virus to wear itself out so they don't infect other people. And if that's a person who's committed a crime, that could be 10 years, 15 years, but if the time comes that that mental virus of violence is totally healed, you're sure it's free, doesn't matter how many years they've been inside the jail, they should be let loose
once they're safe again. Maybe that's what I think anyway. Happiness. Are there similarities? Oh my good. Punishment and justice system. Maybe I'll leave that one because I'm running out of time. I've already done one punishment story. What are the English equivalents of Kanika Samadhi, Upachara Samadhi, Apana Samadhi? Kanika Samadhi is momentary stillness. In other words, it doesn't exist. That is one of those words which come from the commentaries which the Buddha never mentioned, and if you understand what it means, it's nonsense. Kanika Samadhi, momentary stillness. You can't be still just for a moment, it doesn't make any sense, it has no meaning. Upachara Samadhi means neighborhood stillness, in other words, you're almost still but not quite. Apana Samadhi means you're totally still. What do they mean, and are they only applicable for advanced meditators? They're applicable for everybody, because when you start meditating, when you are almost into the, even like nimitta states, will be Upachara Samadhi. The jhanas are the full samadhi. Well, that's actually for the meditators. I've been talking about that all week. How does transference of merits work from the scientific point of view? Has this been proven? It's very difficult because ghosts usually don't allow themselves to be used in laboratories, so we can't actually test whether the merits have actually been transferred to the ghosts. However, monks with psychic powers say, yes, it has worked. They can contact the ghosts and ghosts say, yeah, your check has been received. So you just have to take it on the word of the monks, who you trust. Last question. Okay, no more. Oh no, I've got three questions to go. Here we go, quick, because I can't have any backlog. I am married and not a vegetarian. I only keep three precepts out of five. Can I consider myself a Buddhist? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. When I was in Thailand giving the five precepts to people once, I saw the Thai people putting up their hands when they're taking the five precepts, you know, Panati Pata, Viravani, Adi Nardana, and I noticed one man had his hands up like this. He had one finger down. And I'd never seen that before anywhere. So I asked the man, what are you doing? And he said, today I'm only keeping four precepts. They're very practical, the Thai people. But then I started paying attention. Sure enough, I saw a person with two fingers down. They still do all the chant, Panati part, and they chant everything, but they just keep two fingers down. I even saw one man with his hands like this. Weren't keeping any precepts, but still doing the chanting, so that's not really on. But if you're only keeping three precepts out of five, you can still be a Buddhist as long as you're trying to improve if you possibly can. Because a Buddhist doesn't mean you have to be at this level or that level or another level. It means you really are trying to develop yourself. And if it's only, because I was a Buddhist, I was only keeping four precepts when I first became a Buddhist. I was still drinking alcohol. But after a while, because I was a Buddhist and you were accepted, after a while I saw there wasn't much point drinking alcohol. I was mindfulness and wisdom made me stop. And after a while I just gave it up. So it doesn't matter, you can be a Buddhist with even zero precepts. As long as you're learning at next year one precept, year after two, make one extra every year, then you'll be okay. My wife and I are both practicing Buddhists, but our son, who is 23 years old, is not interested in Buddhism. How do we get him into the picture? Reverse psychology. Tell him that he's banned from going to any Buddhist temples. This actually happened in Australia. There was this one, I think she was a Malaysian girl, she married an Australian man. True story. And she started coming to my temple. She loved the meditation, great talks. And it was not just because she was a Buddhist. They actually helped her in her life, made her a better person. And she desperately wanted to share it with her husband, the man she loved. But you talk to an Australian about going to a church or a temple, no way, I want to watch the TV, I want to watch the football, I want to watch the cricket. He wasn't interested in all this religious nonsense. So she came up to me and said, look, I know he'd enjoy coming here, but he just won't come. How can I get him to be interested? Easy, I said. Buy a copy of my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. Take it home with you. And when you are at home and your husband's there, tell him, darling, this is my book, keep your hands off. And she followed my instructions. Of course it worked. She went home, darling, this is my book, keep your hands off. And when she was out shopping, what did she mean, my book, keep my hands off? And of course he picked it up, read the first story, and never put it down till he finished. Now he comes every week. True story. Reverse psychology. Tell your teenager, no, don't go to the Buddhist temple. Alternatively, if it's your son, 23 years of age, tell him about all these incredibly beautiful chicks who come to the temple. Get him a photograph of like the youth group, because that's the way to get sons to go to the temple. They're not going there to see the monks, they're going there to see the girls. And that works a treat as well. And then when he's there, you know, you hear the talks, and then he won't look at the girls, he'll look at the monks. Dear Ajahn, my daughter, who is a Buddhist, met a boy 1 year ago. This boy is a very staunch Christian. When my daughter came back for overseas recently, she told me that she is already a Christian. As a parent, what would you advise that I do? Thank you. Look, just because, you know, that you're a Buddhist and you fall in love with a Christian, you do not have to convert. It's wonderful to have one person a Buddhist, one a Christian. Why not? It means you have a much wider experience of life to share with your children. And in fact, I do know a couple in Singapore. It's a Buddhist married to a Muslim. And when they said that they're very happy just allowing each other to follow their religion, said, wonderful. When you have children, the first child should be a Christian, the second a Hindu, and the third a Jew, to make it a full family. But don't worry about it. If she has converted from being a Buddhist to a Christian, if she's converted once, she can always convert again. So just, you know, just love her, be kind. If you're a really good Buddhist and a wise, compassionate Buddhist, she'll be impressed. And again, it's actions speak louder than words. And look, overseas, Christianity is declining, Buddhism is improving. In countries like Australia, it's the fastest growing religion. So just wait a while, and when she sees what's really cool and fashionable, Buddhism, then they'll both convert back. It's the same as sometimes I remember telling the chief priests in Bickfields, you know, Venerable Kesavi Dhammananda once, because now, in Malaysia, you do have a problem with evangelicals. Sometimes you're a Buddhist, you're getting old, you're dying, you may have like a son or a nephew or someone who's one of these evangelical Christians, and around your deathbed, they bring the pastor and all their friends to try and convert you. And that's such a pain for someone who's already got enough pain, they're dying. And you get all these people, come on, Dad, convert. You must convert. I want you to convert. Please convert. And that gives you a headache. So my advice, if that's you, you know, you're dying, maybe only a few hours to live, and your relation or with the pastor is badgering you, pressuring you to convert to being a Christian, convert. Become a Christian. Because then they will be happy, and then they will leave you alone. As soon as they've gone out the door, then you can convert back to being a Buddhist. You've got rid of them. Best way. Practical. You can convert one way, you can convert another way. Conversion is not a one-way street, two ways. So, that finishes all the questions with no backlog, because I have to go away tomorrow, back to Singapore and then to Australia. So I hope you really enjoyed everything and all these talks, especially a nice fun talk this evening about Tales of a Forest Monk, a few silly jokes like, remember, bungee jumping and parachuting. Something you can tell people when you get home. And if you tell the Christians, you get much better jokes in the Buddhist temple you get in the church, maybe then they might convert. So now we can do the sharing of merits for you all. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Itam menyatinang hotu sukhita hansu yatayo sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, have great lives. See you next year. Happy New Year, everybody. And have a great life, and I'll see you next time in Penang or anywhere else in the world. Good night.